are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on today's show, Kamala Paseen, is a poet, author, and a feminist activist by training. She has been actively engaged with issues related to development, gender, democracy, and human rights since 1970. She's the South Asia coordinator of 1 Billion Rising, a global campaign to end violence against women and girls, co-chair of the worldwide network Peace Women Across the Globe, and member of South Asians for Human Rights. She currently works with Sangat, a feminist network, as advisor, as well as Jagori, a women's resource and training center. Prior to this, she worked with the UN Food and Agriculture Organization for 27 years. She's committed to the creation of a peaceful, democratic, and pluralist South Asia. Welcome to the podcast, Kamala ji. Thank you for being here today. Let's get started. Tell us about your journey. How did you come to be an activist and a feminist?
So I think this journey is related to my being. I was born in 1946 in a village in Punjab, which then became Pakistan, but grew up in Rajasthan, where my father was a medical doctor. And he preferred to be working in rural areas, in rural dispensaries. And we used to be transferred every 3 years. So I went to school in Mufassil towns and in really small villages. And up to my class 10, there was no electricity in our homes. And the schools, you can imagine, in the late 50s, there was really hardly any education. So after I went to government schools, government college, government university, then I got an opportunity to go to Germany to study. And I lectured in Germany for 1 year. I could have stayed on for life, very highly paid. But after 11 months of that job, I resigned. I was now 25, 26, and I said, no, I need to go back home and work. And for me, work was somehow only in rural areas, in some NGO. I did not want to join the private sector. I didn't want to do anything just to make money. So I went to Seva Mandir, Udaipur, because I knew the founder, who was the vice chancellor in Rajasthan University, where I studied. He kept in touch with me and encouraging me to come and work there. My so-called activism started with working for what we used to then call development, anti-poverty. It wasn't as a feminist that I started. And there, Seva Mandir was mainly doing literacy work. But after 6-8 months, I decided not to do that because I found out that it was not people's demand. It's not what people wanted. It's middle-class people who, because we were literate, we thought they should want it.
Yeah.
What they needed was water. And we were blind because our taps had running water. So once they started trusting me, they said, how blind could we be? Can't we see that this is the worst drought almost of the century? And you are talking of literacy. So I started working on water, helping them deepen their wells. In that work, I understood all the inequalities there were: caste inequality, class inequality, education inequality, and of course, man, woman, girl, boy inequality. The wells which had water were always upper caste wells on which so-called lower caste people were not allowed to step. If government scheme came, it would always go to the sarpanch's relations, etc., and never to the Dalit group. And then I realized that among the poor, women were poorer. Among the Dalits, women were more Dalit. Among the Adivasis, there were more Adivasi. Slowly, I became a conscious feminist. I think I was a feminist in my childhood because I did not allow people to impose things because I was a girl. I didn't allow that. But I heard the word feminist in Seva Mandir in 1974, almost at the age of 28. While there, I started writing because there were very few people who had been educated in cities and had been abroad who came back to the villages to help the people. So our perspective was different. And at that time, I had no idea that just when I had left a job in Germany and come to work in the rural India, that there were many other young people of my age who had also left their fancy jobs either abroad or in India. So people from IIT Bombay, people from Massachusetts Institute in the US, people from St. Stephen's College like Bunker Roy and others, architects, medical doctors, and so on, that community developed. So this is how, Sudha, my so-called activism started.
Your journey to conscious feminism.
But my development activism never stopped. So for me, it was not either a feminist or a development activist, because I think these are all interrelated things. And human rights are related to women's rights. They are related to Dalit rights. So right from the beginning, all these systems have been connected in my mind. And my work has been related to all these.
Tell us more about Indian feminist struggle. And is it really different from the West? You have often challenged the idea that Indian feminist movement found its inspiration in the West.
First of all, I really don't think that there is any Indian feminist struggle or Western feminist struggle.
Okay.
Which West? The Black West or the White West? The minority West or the majority West? Similarly in India, which feminist struggle? So first of all, I want to say that feminism is not one. There are feminisms. And in the large women's movement, there are many, many strands. So for example, in the so-called Western feminism, the Black women told the white women that your feminism is only about white women. We are not included. And they were not included because feminism was only about gender inequality for the white.
Yeah.
But the Black woman wanted gender and race. Similarly, in India, the Dalit women, they told us, why do you never talk of caste? Why are you only talking of patriarchy? So there are many kinds of feminists. Now, feminists, who for me are women and men.
Yes.
Feminism for me is not biological. So women can be patriarchal and feminist. Similarly, men are patriarchal and some men are also feminist and have always been.
Yeah.
So feminism is a response to patriarchy. We have taken our constitution seriously, and the constitution says men and women are equal. All the castes are equal. All religions are equal. I believe whatever I'm doing for the last 50 years now,
yeah,
is to implement my constitution, to implement the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, nothing else. And feminism is both local and global. In America, they have no dowry, so they never fought dowry. They have no sati, they have never fought sati. Yeah. But rape is there. Rape is there in America.
Yeah.
Domestic violence is there in America.
Yeah.
Salary differential between men and women for the same work is there in America. So those things are here as well. I feel perhaps the first feminist might have been born the day patriarchy was created.
Yes.
Because women who were free and were now suddenly being put down wouldn't have taken it nicely.
Yes.
If we study the origin of patriarchy, we see that it took two to 3,000 years. For patriarchy to be established in different parts of the world. But has my constitution given me equal rights? They've just written about them. We may not have a history of these feminist struggles because of colonialism and because of white supremacy.
Yeah.
And because of Brahmanical supremacy, we only have history of some feminists and some struggles, and then we start feminism from last century or century before that from America and say feminism started there.
If we just look at India at this point in time, we've seen a spate of violence against women from economically weaker sections of society. Should this be framed within the caste lens? And does caste equal race?
You know, violence against women, it's a global phenomenon. During COVID-19, the first country to say that domestic violence is doubling was France. It wasn't the poor in India.
No.
And violence against women takes place all over. Me Too movement came from the top echelons of society. What is violence against women? Man who's more powerful doing violence to women. If with that patriarchal violence, you have the power of the boss also. So he is doubly powerful. Violence against women is in homes like yours and in homes like mine. I personally sometimes think that middle-class women face more violence, but they don't talk about it. Adivasi woman is much freer. She'll talk about it. She'll leave because she is economically more independent than middle-class housewives. So yes, many times violence against women is related to caste. These are power systems, and when two power hierarchies come together, it becomes easier to do violence. Caste and race are the same. Caste activists, Dalit activists, have always said that it is like race. But it is not exactly race, because race is based on color.
Yeah.
This is based on a Hindu system of caste, but they are both by birth. They are both nurtured in the same way. Our constitution said India will not follow a caste system. It should have disappeared. But we are not just a Hindu society, but Hindu caste system has made an entry into Indian Christianity, into Indian Islam. It has made an entry even into Sikhism, which was anti-caste. Because all these religions, who became Sikh and Christian and Muslim? Mainly lower caste Hindus, who were not finding respect in their own religion. But people never forgot. They still remember after hundreds of years. So this is what I feel, and I feel very, very sad that these hierarchies are continuing. But I'm not surprised.
As you mentioned, our constitution, you know, the way our constitution is framed, caste should have disappeared. But we have a lot of enablers of caste inequities in this century, including politics and our election system.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah.
Are we, as a society, nurturing casteism?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, inter-caste marriages only. I mean, you don't see inter-caste marriages, inter-religious marriages. And earlier, it was being done, but at least it was not being glorified. So instead of these things disappearing with right-wing politics, these things are being revived. I mean, earlier, you would be ashamed to say these things. People who have always felt it can now say it. It has become legitimate. So yes, but again, I would say it is a global phenomenon. The European societies cannot live without immigrants. I mean, how anti-immigrant they become every time they face an economic problem. Instead of blaming neoliberalism and globalization, they blame those poor
immigrants.
And why are those people immigrants? Because these white countries have made them refugees. If they had not gone and destroyed their countries, there would be no refugees, and not so many anyway.
There's so many things intrinsically linked to each other. The rise of ultra-nationalism and identity politics, just how we live in our society. When I was growing up, I never thought that we will see an India where there is so much of intolerance. In debates about inequalities and the iniquities against women in India, people tend to go back to ancient texts. In recent references to atrocities on women, critics have blamed scriptures and texts, including the infamous Manu. So we know that patriarchy is inherent to Indian society and most societies. What is your take on this?
Listen, this is nothing new. one who has been talked by Periyar, he has been talked by Baba Sahib Ambedkar. I mean, the anti-caste movement in the South has talked about all this. As you said, patriarchy is in every society, and I think all religions are patriarchal. All of them are male-created, male-dominated, male-interpreted, male-imposed religions, each one of them. And definitely, Manu Smriti was written at a time to strengthen patriarchy and to strengthen the caste system. So obviously, I think to bring Manu into running the present society is pathetic.
Yeah.
And so both sides are bringing the scriptures. It's not just the critics of Manu are bringing the scriptures. I mean, you'll be maybe not surprised, but in the Rajasthan High Court, there is a statue of Manu there, and people, the anti-caste people, have been saying for decades, please remove it. You know, like in the US and in Europe now, they are taking down the statues of racist leaders. I don't look at India as a Hindu country, because India is a multi-religious country.
Yeah.
And everybody in India does not follow Manu. I mean, the Sikhs don't and the Christians don't, but they follow their own Manu.
Yeah.
I mean, each religion has its own Manu.
Yeah.
I find all religions are problematic, and we need to finally make up our mind someday, are we with our constitution, and are we with these things which were said 4,000 years ago?
So this is so fascinating. Yeah, I think patriarchy is something that we can talk about for days altogether, years. Kamlaji, you've spoken...
And religions, and caste.
Absolutely. Kamlaji, you have spoken out against capitalism as an agent of patriarchy. The reality is that we live in a capitalist society. What is the model that you would espouse? What is your aspiration for society? I think we see now that there has to be a social contract so that people are able to live with dignity. What would you say about that?
As you know, I'm not a philosopher, but has capitalism worked? You said socialism hasn't worked, communism hasn't worked, but do you think capitalism has worked?
No.
And for whom has it worked? And has it worked for Africa? Has it worked for 70% of Indians? Has it worked for the Black Americans? And has it worked for planet Earth? Has it worked for Mother Nature? I mean, USA should have been that society where inequality should have disappeared, where there should have been health for all. But look at COVID-19 and the USA and the tiny country Cuba next to the USA.
Yeah.
Sending help out all over the world and sending doctors all over the world.
Yes.
And say that, you know, communism hasn't worked, socialism hasn't worked. And again, look at Scandinavia. So the image one has is that societies should not be greed-based, dog-eat-dog kind of competition-based, individualism-based, you know, social welfare, welfare economics, those kinds of things. You know, I mean, I think Scandinavia has shown us the way. We can go that way. And I think the recent catastrophes in the USA of all kinds, including during COVID-19, show us, and it is good to see that in a country like the UK, people are now perhaps understanding the importance of national health services.
Yes.
Even the Conservatives sitting there should see. And so that is the kind of thing we have in mind. But in fact, looking at the climate change scenario, the old socialism, which did not talk of climate, which did not talk of environment, which thought human beings were on top of nature. I think today, ecology and socialism and welfare, etc., and feminism and anti-caste, anti-race kind of things. All these isms need to come together, make alliances, and think of an alternative society. And I think theoretically all this is happening. I mean, people have been talking about it for a long time, what needs to be done. But people who are greed-based people, I mean, even during COVID-19, their profits have soared.
Yes.
Yeah, all these companies have made money. So I really don't think capitalism has worked for the majority. And the marriage, the horrible marriage between capitalism and patriarchy,
it's is double bind. Yeah.
Completely. So that's what I feel.
Okay. From there, let's move to one of your big passion projects, the 1 billion rising movement that you were leading. Tell us more about what it aspires to do and what it has achieved.
Now, 1 billion rising started in 2012, thought of originally by one woman called Eve Wensler. You might have heard of her play, The Vagina Monologues.
Yes.
And in 2012, World Health Organization came up with a report saying, in the world, globally, out of every three women, one woman faces violence at some time in her life. Out of three women, one woman, which means out of a population of 7 billion people, 3.5 billion are women.
Yes.
Out of that, one third, more than a billion women and girls face violence.
Staggering.
Is there a war bigger than this?
No.
Where does this war take place most of all? Within the family, particularly in India. Where is this violence maximum? Where do we kill daughters in the womb? Where do we kill them for dowry? Where do we starve them? Within the family. So then Eve Wensler called me up and said, Kamla, let's start something called 1 billion rising. And I said, let's. We just had to contact our feminist friends all over the world. And we had feminist friends. I knew you, you knew her, you knew him. And within about 9 months, we managed to do 1 billion rising in 207 countries.
Wow.
And what was the slogan? Strike, meaning hit out at violence, dance, and rise. Rise like the waves of the ocean. So people said, why dance? Especially in South Asia. And we said, dance because we are not rising as victims anymore. We are rising as survivors. We will not only dance, we will sing, we will shout slogans, we will be happy together. So we are rising as survivors. And I coordinate 1 billion rising in South Asia. And every year it has become bigger. And every year, it takes the topic of that year. Like this year, the topic is rising gardens. Gardens means greenery. Gardens means partnership with nature. Garden means saving the planet Earth. Garden means nurturing. Also saluting those people who have been nurturing and caring for COVID-19 people all over the world. The front line people against COVID. So we are celebrating Mother Nature, Mother Earth, mothering, nurturing, caring.
Sounds really incredible and all the best. And of course, you all have been doing so well. I've read so much about it. In your writings and activism, Kamlaji, you always allude to feminist movement that transcends class, borders, and other binary social divisions. You've spoken about it at the start also. But how can we make this a reality?
Now, I think you can see how it is becoming a reality. For example, we wanted women to be together. And then the Dalit woman says, listen, I'm not just a woman. And you are not just a woman. You are an upper caste woman. And I'm a lower caste woman. And if I was working with poor women, they said, you are not just a woman. You are an upper class woman. And I'm a working class woman. So if you want women to be together, then you have to think of our struggles. So now look at Indian feminism. Right from the beginning, with whom were we working? We were working with Basti women, with poor women.
Yeah.
But in any case, middle class women will not allow us into their homes.
Yeah.
They're not going to give up patriarchy that easily because patriarchy is bringing their class status to them.
Yeah.
A upper middle class woman will not leave her husband.
Never.
Because with the husband, maybe her car will go and her fancy house will go and
her status
and kitty parties and the jewelry will go. So in India, we have always worked with women from the working classes, working castes, and made alliances with them, with indigenous women. So I feel, for example, in the last 10 years, with LGBTIQ people, to some extent, these alliances are coming up, but sometimes they also divide us. Because today, everybody wants their rights. I have a severely handicapped son. He's 40 years old. And as a 74-year-old mother, I can't look after him alone. And because of my class, I have people looking after him. So am I a feminist even with those people who look after my son? Do I take care of them? So I think we need these alliances if we want our movements to be bigger. Identity politics divides us. But can I tell a Dalit woman, don't talk of caste? Can the white women in US tell the black women, don't talk of race? So I see that intersectionality is absolutely essential, and these alliances have to be made. But I feel that ultimately it is poor versus rich. And I think if the poor have to unite, alliances are necessary. If the women have to get anywhere, alliances are necessary.
So the future is collaboration, alliances, and then moving forward to address your issues.
And now even global alliances. The British have been our colonial masters. But today, we have enough white people who are looking at the globe as citizens of this earth rather than as colonial masters. So I think global issues need global solutions, and we need to also forget my colonial status, and the Brits in US, UK need to forget their colonial master status. And we need to come together as citizens of planet Earth. And if we don't do it, we won't make it.
Kamlaji, the next question, you've addressed a bit of it in your last response, because the next question is, why is activism at the periphery of society? And does it not need to be mainstream for change to happen?
First of all, what is our definition of activism? I mean, from your question, I assume you think only people who want to bring rights for all and development for all are activists, but we are not the only activists. I think capitalism today has more activists than human rights activists.
True.
Mr. Trump has his activists. Right-wing party has its activists. Labour Party has its activists. So what is activism? So I think activism is very active, but they are active for their own goals. People like me want the Constitution of India to be implemented, but only human rights activism might seem at the periphery, because our governments are becoming anti-human rights, because the power of the people who control digital world and the data is controlling that. I know that young people, at least in India, haven't given up activism. And if young people like Greta Thunberg in Sweden can become an activist, and Malala from Pakistan, the youngest Nobel Peace laureate. I will not insult the young people of today. But the thing is that this greed-based neoliberalism has proven to be very, very powerful.
To end the interview, please share your advice on things individuals, governments, private sector can do to foster change.
Governments have to do that. But we are so-called democracies. And it's up to us what kind of governments we bring. But today, I don't think many people will believe that we are genuine democracies. So one has to put more and more pressure all the time and select governments who will work for Mother Earth, for planet Earth, who will work for the most needy. As Gandhiji said, think of the last person. Maybe, but private sector, as a sector, I don't have great expectations from them. Because as a sector, the main motivation to me seems to be profit. And again, as Gandhiji said, Mother Earth has enough for everyone's need, but not for everyone's greed. So if less than 1% of people in the world can control 40 to 50% resources of the world, this capitalist world has failed for me.
True.
Yes, within the capitalist, there can be people like Azim Premji. There can be people like Anu Aga. There can be people like Tata. But those are as rare as the wonderful bureaucrats which we have had in India, who did amazing work. They did what they were supposed to do. Some judges did what they were supposed to do, but fewer and fewer of those being allowed by the governments.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Kamlaji.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.